I told them when they put this guy here, it's nothing but trouble. He's a showboat. If you keep talking, I'll leave and you can have it out with the rest of these people. Just a loudmouth.
The Dory Monson Show on Cairo Radio. This is The Big Lead.
Why, I never come to you from the remote Carter Subaru studio. This is kind of a bombshell that the president just dropped a few minutes ago. You heard us talking about it right before the top of the hour. Now I have the audio. And in fact, actually, Nicole, I do not have the audio still. You're going to have to play it. You there?
Hey, yeah, I'm here.
Okay, you're going to have to fire this audio. It's still not loading for me.
Our computers are melting down, so I might have to have Sean do it for me.
Sean, can you play this Trump audio here?
You're looking for the one about the hydroxychloroquine?
That's it?
Hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah, yep. Right. Okay. Mine's showing up as an error as well.
Gosh, darn it. Hold on, I'll send
it. Let me just tell people. Okay, keep working on getting it loaded. And let me just tell people that President Trump, this was not an official. In fact, let me get to the big lead breaking news here.
The big lead breaking news.
So he was having a roundtable with restaurant industry leaders at the White House. And then he did some Q&A with reporters. And the president dropped an absolute bombshell. He announced that he has been taking hydroxychloroquine for the last week and a half. Now, he says that he does not have any symptoms of coronavirus. He says that he consulted with the White House doctor and that he is taking it as a prophylactic, that he just wants, if there is some benefit, he wants to avail himself to that benefit of hydroxychloroquine. Now, you remember when he talked about this a few weeks ago, and then the fake news media rushed to get a story out that people who were taking hydroxychloroquine were dying at a higher rate. And it was, again, the fakiest of fake news because they were giving the hydroxychloroquine to people who were, you know, close to dying from coronavirus. They were desperately ill. And so, of course, you know, with or without hydroxychloroquine, they had a higher fatality rate. And this was a study that had absolutely zero medical or statistical validity. But I heard the network news, other talk shows, they're running with this. The Trump is promoting this hydroxychloroquine, and it's killing more people than it's saving. And everyone ignored that the fake news story about it had zero statistical validity. And by even the people who reported it, no medical validity. But the fact that Trump is taking this and has been for a week and a half, I will tell you that I personally know of doctors and nurses who have been getting prescriptions for hydroxychloroquine. And I don't know if they've been taking it, the ones that I know personally, or if they've just been kind of stashing it for themselves and their families. But I do know of people in the healthcare industry who have gotten a supply of hydroxychloroquine. Now, it's a drug that's originally for malaria. If you're traveling to countries with high malaria rates, primarily Africa. Also, if you have lupus, it is a drug that is often prescribed for people suffering from lupus. And I know that lupus sufferers are nervous because they're afraid that if there's a widespread run on hydroxychloroquine among the general public, that maybe they won't get what is an essential drug for treatment of their disease. But now there's, of course, all kinds of conspiracy theories already flying around social media and in the, you know, even more mainstream media that just despises this president and has been rooting almost openly for him to get sick. I mean, you know, it's like that, it was a fairly mainstream site. I don't remember if it was Vox, what site it was. But Mike Pence's communications director, she, it was revealed last week, tested positive for coronavirus. And her husband, Stephen Miller, is a, it's Jezebel was the website. Pence's communication director's husband is Stephen Miller, who is a top advisor for President Trump. And on Jezebel, which is a somewhat mainstream, it's, you know, not even considered left wing. That's not their identity. It's mainly a, you know, women and women's issues, women topic site. But they had a story last week from one of their senior writers and editors saying, I hope Stephen Miller dies of coronavirus. Now, I'm not making this up. This is the level of insanity that has gripped so many people. But so we're already seeing, after Donald Trump said that he's been taking hydroxychloroquine for the last week and a half.
Jerry, I happen to have that cut that Nicole was talking about.
Oh, do you? Yeah. Oh, bless your heart, Sean. Okay, so here's what the president said just moments ago.
Why would he sign it? And a lot of good things have come out about the hydroxy. A lot of good things have come out. And you'd be surprised at how many people are taking it, especially the frontline workers, before you catch it. The frontline workers, many, many are taking it. I happen to be taking it.
Hydroxychloroquine?
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine.
When?
Right now, yeah.
Yeah,
a couple of weeks ago, I started taking it. Because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories. And if it's not good, I'll tell you right, I'm not going to get hurt by it. It's been around for 40 years for malaria, for lupus, for other things. I take it. Frontline workers take it. A lot of doctors take it. Excuse me. A lot of doctors take it. I take it. Now, I hope to not be able to take it soon because, you know, I hope they come up with some answer. But I think people should be allowed to. I got a letter from a doctor the other day from Westchester, New York, around the area. He didn't want anything. He just said, sir, I have hundreds of patients, and I give them hydroxychloroquine. I give them the Z-Pak, which is zithromycin, and I give them zinc. And out of the hundreds of patients, many hundreds, over 300 patients, I haven't lost one. He said, please keep pressing that, sir. And if you look at that phony report that was put in, that report on the hydroxy was given to people that were in extraordinarily bad condition. Extraordinarily bad. People that were dying. No, I think for whatever it's worth, I take it. I was I would have told you that 3-4 days ago, but we never had a chance because you never asked me the question.
The White House, did the White House doctor recommend that you take that? Is that why you're taking
it? Let's stay with it. Stay with it, Sean.
No, I asked him, what do you think? He said, well, if you'd like it. I said, yeah, I'd like it. I'd like to take it. A lot of people are taking it. A lot of frontline workers are taking hydroxychloroquine. A lot of front. I don't take it because, hey, people said, oh, maybe he owns the company. No, I don't own the company. You know what? I want the people of this nation to feel good. I don't want them being sick. And there's a very good chance that this has an impact, especially early on. But you look at frontline workers, you look at doctors and nurses, lot of them are taking it.
He's repeating himself now, so I will jump in on that. But that was just moments ago, Donald Trump announcing that as a prophylactic, he's taking hydroxychloroquine in an effort to avoid coronavirus. And so We'll see more as this story develops, but it's just kind of a bombshell because the story earlier today and the reason the Dow was up 911 points was on reports that they think they may be close to a coronavirus vaccine by maybe the end of the year, and that they could have millions of doses, and they could start with the healthcare professionals and then the people in the highest risk categories. And then, I don't understand. I'm sure there's a good reason. I don't understand the production of pharmaceuticals. But once something gets the green light, I truly don't understand. If they can produce millions by the end of the year, why couldn't they produce a couple hundred million for everybody in the country who wants it? And I'm sure there are some production restrictions that I'm just simply not aware of. But that's what fueled all the optimism on Wall Street today. And then in the midst of all that, Trump, as I heard one person say, he just kind of landed a cannonball in the pool and said, yeah, I'm taking hydroxychloroquine. So that's the latest from our prez. By the way, Jay Inslee, we are expecting a press conference from the governor. That's due to begin in 14 minutes. You will hear that live here on the Dory Monson Show. The governor is starting to lose an awful lot of support, as we exclusively told you last Thursday. And a few have picked up on it, but not very many. Jay Inslee went on Bernie Sanders' Bernie Bro website and said that he looks at the economic meltdown of our state as an opportunity for his climate change agenda.
This has always been an economic opportunity, but it is such a no-brainer at this moment with the COVID crisis that has precipitated this enormous economic challenge. And we should not miss an opportunity to drive home what Varshi was talking about, that this has enormous backing in our constituents to understand the economic necessity of this. And we should not be intimidated when people say, oh, you can't use this COVID crisis, you know, to peddle a solution to climate change. No.
Just repulsive. Repulsive. He is focused still on climate change when there are a million newly unemployed, tens of thousands of businesses facing bankruptcy, and he's excited about the opportunity for his climate change agenda. After I played that on my show last Thursday, the mayor of Burlington, Washington, Steve Sexton, he emailed me and he said, Dory, is that a spoof? Did Inslee really say that? And this is a guy who's been an ally of Jay Inslee's. But he said, if he's truly going to make this about climate change and not just getting the economy back up and running as quickly, as efficiently as possible. I talked with Mayor Sexton a couple of hours ago.
When we look at where we are today, Saturday, our food bank here in Burlington normally hands out about 150 meals a week, is doing about 750 or more. Many of them middle-class families who are choosing between buying food and paying rent or mortgage.
Yeah,
we have businesses that are struggling. I've got one business here in town that they've been in business 70 years selling shoes, wondering how do we get opened.
And so Jay Inslee, in the midst of this, is talking about how can I use this as an opportunity for my climate change agenda. And the mayor said Inslee got caught doing something that he doesn't do very often.
At this time, if we can't set our agendas aside, set our politics aside, and set our party differences aside, for that matter, and come together, we don't have a whole lot to be proud of, honestly. And it feels like, to me, it felt like the governor got caught telling the truth.
Jay Inslee got caught telling the truth. Yeah. And we continue to, you know, just have these incredibly sad economic numbers. And Tucker Carlson, a couple nights ago on his show, he was talking about when Georgia reopened, for example, the politicians and the media predicted absolute doom, gloom, widespread death.
We honestly don't understand.
Oh, this is Stacey Abrams, the failed gubernatorial candidate.
We honestly don't understand. The mayors of our largest cities have all expressed deep concern, as have our scientists. This makes no sense, and it doesn't improve our economy. It simply puts more Georgians at risk.
But let me give you some stats. Let me give you some facts. I know fact is the four-letter word that the left hates the most. Our four most populous states are California, Texas, Florida, and New York. California and New York both have huge state income taxes. They both have a gigantic budget deficit. California's $54 billion in debt. New York is $6 billion in debt. Texas and Florida both have balanced budgets. COVID-19 deaths, New York, 27,000. California, 2,800. Texas, 1,100. Florida, 1,700. The states that opened up the fastest, Florida and Texas, have by far per capita the lowest mortality rate. There doesn't seem to be a correlation. So why are we destroying our economy for all of this? Why are we driving businesses into bankruptcy? Why do we have families crying themselves to sleep at night because they've been without a paycheck for so long? And by the way, Jay Inslee's kind of a national laughingstock now.
Washington Governor Jay Inslee, not a math guy. He's not calculating probabilities like this. Inslee apparently believes that everyone in Washington state faces the real likelihood of dying from the virus. And that's why he's ordered officials in the state to track who goes to restaurants and who they eat with. Because that's not a Chinese police state tactic or anything.
This contact tracing, obviously, if you have somebody who's become sick and they were sitting right next to a person at a restaurant, to be able to identify that person could be very valuable for their health to try to save their life. And so we put that in place.
Yeah, it's kind of weird that the authorities are taking notes on who you're having dinner with. But, you know, it's for the public health, so submit. It's not like politicians would ever misuse that information or anything. So sleep well. And don't forget to send in a blood sample so the government can sequence your DNA for public health reasons.
And Jay Inslee has already reversed field on the restaurant, give your private info, because it was so ridiculous and poorly thought out to begin with. So he'll probably announce the backtracking on that at his press conference that starts in just 7 minutes. And for now, that is your big lead this hour.
The Big Lead on Cairo Radio.
Okay, if he gets going on time, and he usually has been pretty punctual, I hate to take time away that you and I usually share together, but we'll take you live to Olympia and hear the latest from our governor. That is coming up next here on the Dory Monson Show. How did we miss this Ryan Seacrest story? Before this, Ryan Seacrest was slurring and had an eye wider open. I think I've got that on my dish records all primetime television. So I'm gonna watch and see what was going on with Seacrest last night. That he was off his show today. Nicole, I always get in trouble when I comment on women's looks, right? Can I make a comment?
Yes.
About a woman's looks right now.
Oh, if you feel getting in trouble today.
No, it's a compliment.
Oh,
it's a
okay.
compliment. So we're waiting for Inslee's
Matthews.
No. are you kidding? I don't have that whole creepy DNA that Chris Matthews and all those guys have. I think I've established who and what I am by now. But we're waiting for Inslee's press conference to begin. And so we've got TVW as a source for the audio. And then I also have a TV in my home office where I'm broadcasting. And so I'm checking out the local TV stations. And, oh, my gosh, daytime television is just simply awful. But I just flipped on Channel 4 and Kelly Clarkson has a talk show. I wasn't aware of this. The former American Idol winner.
Oh, yeah. That's been going on
yeah,
a while.
And she's doing the home, the show from her home this week. And last week I saw that they had reruns where she was in studio with an audience. She doesn't have any makeup on when she's working from home. I have never seen somebody who is so much more beautiful without makeup than with makeup.
I would say she probably just doesn't have her usual makeup team. She probably has some makeup on. I'm sure there's some foundation, you know.
She might have
like that,
a little. When she has all the caked on makeup that she always has for that singing show she's a judge on and for her usual talk show, it's just not attractive. And here she is, and, you know, maybe you would know if she's wearing makeup a tiny bit, but to my eyes, she's not wearing any. And she's just much, much, much more beautiful without makeup. And I don't know why people don't tell her that. I don't know why she thinks she has to have it all caked on in every other appearance. She should just be au naturel like this in most of her appearances. So that's my compliment to somebody.
Okay.
Commenting
that's
on
fair.
Someone's look.
I don't think you'll get in too much trouble.
I can't. I said something very, very nice. Just take the makeup off, for crying out loud. While we're waiting for Jay Inslee live from Olympia, I will also tell you that, once again, our state seems to stand alone as the only one that's poorly equipped, according to Inslee, with the testing supplies. Inslee seems to be the only governor. There are all kinds of far-left governors, Gavin Newsom in California, Andrew Cuomo in New York. They're getting along fine, even great, with Trump. But Jay Inslee is the only governor who cannot get along with Trump. And I think it's because Inslee is so bitter that he got 0% in the Democratic polls when he was running for president a few months ago. And he doesn't want to be governor for a third term. He is dreading. He hates being governor of Washington. And so all his bitterness is coming out. And I was going to play you a compare and contrast of him versus Cuomo. But I think the governor is about to start speaking in Olympia. What I will tell you, tell me when you're ready to switch to it, Sean. As always, I'm going to go through, I will log every second of this press conference, and I will, on tomorrow's show, I will have a complete recap and analysis of everything that the governor is about to tell us. We ready to go to Olympia, Sean?
He is. Yep, let's do it.
All right. We take you to Olympia live here on the Dory Monson Show.
The first in the nation to be challenged by the COVID-19 when there was still much that we were learning about the coronavirus. And because of the great work of our healthcare professionals, the contributions of all Washingtonians who have remained true to the stay home, stay healthy initiative, we've managed the peak of the COVID-19 assault without having our hospitals and our medical systems absolutely overrun. And when we think about that, I hope people will think about the heroism of people in our healthcare system who made that possible. People like Dr. Ryan Padgett. Dr. Padgett was a doctor at Evergreen Medical Center in Kirkland. He contracted COVID-19 in March. He spent more than 2 weeks on a ventilator during what he called a brush with death. And he's one of the many healthcare workers in our state who've really put their lives on the line. And that's not a figure of speech. It is an absolute reality. And it's all of the medical professionals, the nurses, the phlebotomists, the maintenance workers, the ambulance drivers, everybody on these teams, we just want to thank. And I think that we want to minimize their risk. And that's why we put limits on the amount of non-urgent medical care so that we could preserve the personal protective equipment that these heroes needed. We know right now that this virus remains a threat to our health and our way of life, and we know that PPE and testing capability remain challenges. But we believe now that with appropriate
safety measures, we can now start the process of getting back to non-urgent medical and dental care. So today I'm issuing a proclamation that allows for the reopening of our health care services, including dentists, assuming they can comply with the new health and safety protocols that are necessary to keep everyone healthy. And the level of increase that this proclamation will allow will depend on the ability to be prepared for a potential COVID onslaught should this bite us again. So we basically, this is one more step, and we think of this as a pacing item, how we're going to pace ourselves to reopen our economy. And one of the things we'll be looking at is looking at our PPE capacity for contact tracing. We're going to see how these impact our plans going forward, but we're glad we can take this first step right now. This plan was developed with many people, partners in the healthcare delivery system, nurses, surgeons, pediatricians, dentists, community health clinics, and hospitals. And they all worked together to come up with this new protocol. I'd like to thank Sally Watkins, the executive director of the Washington State Nurses Association, and Bill Robertson, CEO of MultiCare Health System. They both provide excellent leadership, and many others in associations did as well. They're joining us remotely today to discuss a little bit of the plan. And also here to answer questions is retired Navy Vice Admiral Raquel Bono, who's been leading our healthcare preparedness efforts. And I think you'll see some of her handiwork in this discussion today. So aside from being determined by the COVID-19 activity in different regions of our state, the reopening of our healthcare system is going to be based on three standards of care. Readiness will be determined by the availability of PPE, hospital capacity, and more. As this graph shows, statewide, we feel good about the number of ICU beds as well as the number of ventilators in our state to allow us to move forward in this regard. Under this plan, each healthcare or dental provider will need to meet certain criteria to be able to be doing non-urgent procedures. Each provider evaluates their readiness to begin and needs to maintain standards to continue to see patients. One of the most important requirements for any provider, of course, is that they have appropriate personal protection equipment for their workers and their patients and themselves. And if they cannot procure PPE, then they're just going to delay until that is satisfied. We've provided systems to help healthcare providers figure out whether they have the necessary PPE. We'll be providing this guidance on the screen to them and providing it to media as well. It basically indicates when you've got enough to justify moving forward with these procedures. Now, we recognize, unfortunately, it's still difficult to purchase certain types of PPE. And it's possible there'll be providers who have to adjust their reopening plans due to these limitations. And that's why it's critical that providers use good judgment in expanding access to elective care. Our state is doing everything humanly possible to increase PPE options. And that's why we have been very determined and diligent in asking the federal government to be more effective in providing this needed equipment. So there are obviously other additional protocols while we're doing this, involving limiting the number of people in the waiting room, physical distancing, temperature checks, frequent hand washing and hygiene, and more. These are all good common sense and medically necessary things right now, and we're going to trust our folks to do them. Another reason we can reopen more of our healthcare system now is the completion of the state's centralized hospital reporting system. We call it WaHealth. WaHealth allows for real-time tracking of capacity in our state hospitals to ensure that the state can be ready in case there is new COVID-19 activity. I want to thank Admiral Bono particularly for helping build that tool for us. Another thing I want to mention is that, unfortunately, we have seen the presence of COVID-19 sometimes has deterred people from getting what really is necessary medical care. we really hope if you need care, you really need to contact your provider. Don't be afraid of fears of COVID-19. There's other health things that we need to take care of ourselves on. And ask your medical personnel, telemedicine, you can give them a call and talk to them. They may be able to help you over the phone or the computer. And if you're concerned about your care and the use of appropriate health protocols during treatment, you can share your concerns at coronavirus.wa.gov. That's coronavirus.wa.gov under the business and workers page. And this can be done entirely anonymously, by the way, to help us get good information to make sure we're doing the right thing. If you missed some news this morning, our Department of Health has approved a variance for Assotin County to move into phase two of our recovery plan. This makes 10 counties that have been approved to move forward, and that means more business will be able to open up under our phase two in these counties in our four-phase recovery plan. But again, I do want to caution, this is just not a moment to throw off all sense of doing the right thing and showing caution here. Without a vaccine or widely available treatments, we still live in the era of COVID-19. It remains a deadly foe. We just had the just such sad fact that we lost our 1,000 Washingtonians a couple days ago. And as I talked about the other day, this is not a number. These are people. And each one of them is now being mourned by their families. And we should not think of this as a number. We should think of this as human hearts, and I know people do. We are grateful, however, for the commitment of our health and dental partners who protected Washingtonians from a worse outcome. I have a lot of thanks to render. I want to particularly thank the dental community. They really stepped up early, making a very difficult decision to defer some of their practices so that they could save the PPE for the folks who were going to be on the front line in the hospitals. I want to thank them for that. Now I'm going to turn this over to Sally Watkins to make some comments. Sally.
Thank you. It's nice to be here today, and I want to thank you for starting.
This is the head of the Washington State Nurses Association speaking now, Sally Watkins. We are bringing you Governor Inslee's live press conference. I hope you get some challenging questions from the reporters there. Our live coverage continues here on the Dory Monson Show, Cairo FM.
I also want to thank all of those who participated, as we had many, many voices with varied perspectives from multiple different practice settings, from large healthcare systems to single providers. The group recognized that health status is impacted both by social determinants of health and untreated health conditions. They also felt it is vital that public and private sector participants in the healthcare system work to enhance public health capabilities and capacity, such as testing, contact tracing, and follow-up, and that access to appropriate care be expanded as safely as possible. The exercise of clinical judgment by healthcare and dental professionals is essential. But it's also essential that all our health and dental partners follow the same procedures as outlined in this proclamation and work together to protect the health of all our residents. Expansion or contraction of care plans should be operationalized based on the standards of care that are in effect in the practice setting's relevant geography as determined by that region's emergency health care coalition. The three phases that we're recognizing are as follows. The conventional care phase, meaning that all appropriate clinical care can be provided. Contingency care phase, where all appropriate clinical care can be provided so long as there's sufficient access to PPE and for hospitals, surge capacity is at least 20%. The crisis care phase, all emergent and urgent care shall be provided. Elective care that the postponement of which for more than 90 days would, in the judgment of the clinician, cause harm. The full suite of family planning services and procedures, newborn care, infant and pediatric vaccinations, and other preventative care such as annual flu vaccinations can continue. Fortunately, throughout Washington's COVID-19 journey, our healthcare system never had to move to the crisis care phase. Today, most of our state's hospitals are operating in the contingency care phases. What this means for the healthcare system is that these guidelines will provide the needed framework to expand and perhaps contract the provisions of healthcare services. We support the need to ensure patient care needs are met, with providers determining the sense of urgency to address those care needs. We also do not want to experience unintended public health consequences that can come from such issues as delayed administration of vaccines, lack of access to reproductive health care, or delayed diagnosis and treatment. For the nursing profession, this means the stakeholders and participants in development of this new guidance. The Washington State Nurses Association recognizes the need to make procedures and screenings that may have been delayed available to patients to address their health needs and well-being. We support the restart of these procedures in a safe manner that recognizes the ongoing national shortage of PPE, the need to maintain the safety of nurses and other healthcare workers, and the prudent maintenance of surge capacity for a potential resurgence of COVID-19. At the same time, WSNA remains concerned about the limited availability, cleaning procedures, and reuse of personal protective equipment such as surgical masks, N95 respirators, and face shields. The contingency care phase guidelines, which allow for the extended use and reuse of protective equipment intended for single use, must not become the new normal for the safety of healthcare workers and patients alike. We continue to urge the federal government to employ all available means to produce and secure PPE so that we can return to the science-based infection control guidelines at the foundation of the conventional care phase at all healthcare facilities. Embedded in this proclamation is the requirement that practice settings develop a formal employee feedback process to obtain direct input regarding care delivery processes, PPE, and technology availability related to the expansion of care. We will continue to monitor many of these issues as identified in the proclamation, such as testing capabilities, contact tracing as that evolves, PPE, et cetera. We've had nurses laid off or furloughed and are eager to see them to be able to return to work, but we want them to do so safely with the right amount of PPE and other supplies. Nurses and other healthcare workers have cared for patients through the COVID-19 crisis, despite the lack of appropriate protective equipment needed for their own safety, as well as that of their patients and families. It's our duty and responsibility to honor their dedication by ensuring their safety and returning to conventional infection control protocols as quickly as possible. And I can't close without recognizing that 2020 has been designated as the year of the nurse and the midwife, and what a year it has been. Thank you.
Thanks, Sally. I think it should be the decade of the nurse and the midwife. I'll get my vote in for that. Bill Robertson.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you, Governor. First, I want to thank Sally for her excellent partnership in the work we were privileged to do in collaboration with the outstanding participants in the work group. I'm looking forward to meeting Sally in person one of these days when COVID-19 journey is at a place when in-person meetings are, again, something we do. Also, a big thank you to all the participants in the work group for your engaged participation, unique perspectives, and wise counsel. The work we did together will help healthcare organizations, team members, and clinicians be well positioned to effectively and safely care for our patients and communities. And a huge thank you to the clinicians and other healthcare team members who every day show up to care for our patients with professionalism, excellence, and compassion. You are heroes to me, and we are deeply grateful for your outstanding service in the face of challenging times. Finally, my thanks to the governor for his collaborative approach to safely expanding access to needed healthcare services. We're moving forward with the safe start of our economy to mitigate the impact of the state of emergency on social determinants of health. For his recognition of and appreciation for the excellent capabilities and performance of the Washington healthcare system and our team members and clinicians, and for involving a broad array of health system participants in shaping the guidance in his proclamation today. During our state's COVID journey, the collaboration between Washington's many healthcare system provider organizations and clinical professionals in the public and private sector has been crucial to effectively caring for the people affected by the disease. I'm grateful that, working with the governor, Department of Health, and other governmental agencies, we have successfully moderated the impact of the disease on the people and the communities of our state. Washington has an excellent healthcare system with a wide array of excellent clinical professionals healthcare team members, and highly developed healthcare organizations and hospitals. This healthcare system has decades of experience safely and effectively caring for people in an ever-changing environment where there are regular flu seasons, occasional epidemics, and now a pandemic. We are here to ably serve our patients and communities and have always been and are now capable of safely providing the full range of health care that people need and deserve. The healthcare system of Washington is safe, and people should not forego needed care because they are concerned that we are not equipped and staffed to care for you. The majority of care provided during the COVID-19 pandemic has been for people not afflicted by the disease, and we have provided this care safely and exceptionally well. The full array of health issues and disease that existed before COVID continues to be present in our communities and affect people. Stroke, heart attacks, cancer, trauma, and much more. And all of this can and should be treated, along with the necessary diagnostic and preventive care. With many of these health issues and diseases, time is of the essence, and waiting to obtain needed care can have permanent negative consequences up to and including death. So again, my thanks to the governor for creating a path forward that reduces restrictions on and allows for the safe expansion of non-urgent medical and dental procedures.
All right, you're listening to a live press conference from Olympia. I apologize to you. These are brutal, man. These are just absolutely brutal. We're going to have to rethink the merits of carrying these live because just having people reading statements is... It's just brutal. Now we're getting to the reporters. This is KIRO FM, Tacoma, Seattle. Full analysis tomorrow on the Dory Monts Show. Tom and Curly next. Back to Olympia we go. Take care.
Home order on May 31st.
I was not on the call today. I was engaged in some other emergency issues. But if there's anything significant, I'll try to get you some information from that call. As far as June 1, look, we would really like to move to phase two, but we cannot guarantee when that will happen. That will depend on the status of the virus. It will depend on our ability to set up a very strong testing, contact tracing, and isolation protocol. And it will depend on our ability to make sure that those two things we have confidence will continue. And we will be able to make those decisions in the days leading up to that period of time, and not before, unfortunately, and I wish it were otherwise. There would be no greater desire that any of us would have, including myself, maybe first in line, to be able to announce a date today. But that would not be responsible because we have to look at the course of this disease. We have to make smart decisions based on science and data and the status of this virus. And the reason we need to do that is if we were to make the wrong decision, a premature decision, this thing could just bounce right back up. And we would be right back in the soup where we were a couple months ago. So we are hopeful. There have been some signs of progress recently. We had some good numbers yesterday as to the percentage of new admissions to our hospitals that was good news. But we're going to have to monitor this on a daily basis in the next several weeks.
Question comes from Joe with the Seattle Times.
Governor, the Freedom Foundation put out an analysis today on COVID-19 deaths in Washington. They're claiming that as many as 13% of the fatalities are not necessarily related to COVID-19. And the information they cite is death certificates where COVID-19 wasn't listed as the main factor or a contributing factor. I'm curious to get your response to that and what sort of criteria are being used to mark these fatalities.
Well, it's from the official documents, the best information we have from the local health officials. That's the best information we have. I'm not sure the relevance of what that group, I guess they're saying that would make it 887 dead. That's okay. And we should not act responsibly if there's only 887 people instead of 1,000 people. I'm not sure I understand that logic. I don't think anybody does understand it who knows any of these families who've lost a loved one. So I don't think that's a particularly persuasive
argument, even if it was true. But we're making decisions based on the best data that is available. We've been very transparent in the state. And I do have to say this. I think one of the difficulties in this is that the conspiracy theories that are fanning people's efforts to go out and do what this group did and argue that 887 deaths just not something to be worried about is really disappointing to me. I've heard people say things that are from a different planet, and it's very unfortunate that some folks in public life have fanned the flames of misinformation in that regard, because it's dangerous. It's dangerous to people's health, so they become unwilling to protect themselves and their loved ones. So I'm not impressed by what is barely an argument.
Next question comes from Essex with Kyra.
Yes, Governor. First, a question for you and then a question for Mr. Robertson. For you, Governor, you changed your mind on requiring restaurant customers to mandatorily leave their information, such as their phone number and name, when they go into the restaurant. What led you to make that voluntary and to take that risk that there might not be the necessary contact tracing? And for Mr. Robertson, looking at hospital budgets, how important is it that elective medical procedures now be allowed to continue?
Bill, you want to go ahead?
Certainly, thank you. So the impact of COVID and our collective response as a society to COVID on the economic viability of healthcare systems has been immense. It is immense in the state of Washington, but it's immense across the United States. And our business models do rely on elective type procedures to create revenue streams for the support of the healthcare delivery system. We cannot go very long with the level of income that we currently have as healthcare systems and have a viable healthcare system for very long. But I know that most of the healthcare systems in the state of Washington are finding ways forward, and we are receiving some level of federal support in this, but not nearly filling the gap that has been created by the slowing down of access to elective care. And I should say, elective care didn't go away, just a very significant piece of it did. So it's very important to have the economic revenue streams come back in order to have a healthcare system to take care of our communities.
Yeah, Essex, on this decision, we thought about it for a couple days and basically concluded that we think we'll get enough compliance to make this really beneficial, that people voluntarily just leave a phone number, one person per table. We think the majority of people want to do that for their own protection, because if there is an infection that came in the restaurant, they probably would want to be alerted to that so that they could check out their own health. May not be 100%, but we think it'll be enough to really help people. And we just figured that we're going to get enough compliance voluntarily not to be worth it of having disagreements at the reservation counter. So I think this is going to work out just fine. And this is like a lot of things as we go through this. Look, there's no playbook for fighting a pandemic like this. This is a new experience for all our organizations, all our families, certainly the state of Washington. And I think we can expect there will be changes as we learn and react. I mentioned Starbucks has a principle. They're using their recovery plan. They call it monitor and adapt, meaning be agile, look at what you learn, and adapt. I think that's what we did here.
Next question comes from Jim with the Spokesman Review.
Governor, when will the state have for counties with more than 75,000 people, like Spokane, to open up into phase two ahead of the rest of the state? And I noticed your map there as the slides went through has a classification for applied but not eligible for the counties. Shouldn't Spokane have been listed that way on the map?
Well, I think what that meant is the ones that were eligible to apply, and Spokane was too large to be eligible to apply. I think that's what the shading was. And we hope to have more clarity on this in the next couple of days. We're putting the finishing touches on it this afternoon. So I hope in the next couple of days we'll be able to share that with you. And there's been a lot of thought given to it to make sure that we have the right pace to keep people healthy as we reopen. And we want to do that, obviously. So I hope next couple of days we'll have an in-depth discussion about that.
Next question comes from Keith with Coma.
Governor, the president wants to return to large football games. When you look at your four phases, if all goes well, you could be into phase four by mid-July. Do you see a return to large football games, baseball games, soccer matches at that point?
We don't know. And I think the honest answer by anybody in public life is we don't know, because we're going to have to look what the status is then as to the virus, the status of our efforts to do testing and contact tracing, and to what extent people are responding to the need to isolate. And we need to look at all those issues. And to say anything yes or no, black or white at this point, it's really not helpful, because we have to remain vigilant and make the right decisions. We need to make the decisions when we have enough information to make the decisions, and not just make sort of ideological statements that then give people either false confidence or false pessimism. And I think so far we've done well, because we have made decisions based on data in the real time when they need to be made. I do want to mention one thing, too, in this regard. I mentioned that one of the things that will be important in the next several months is our ability for people who have posited COVID to isolate, to make sure they don't go out and infect more people. Whether we can open football games, or when we do, we know we will at some point, depends in no small measure of the ability of families to isolate and make those decisions to stay home for 14 days, the whole family. And I mention this because it's going to be, I think, one of the great determinants of how successful we are in the next couple months. And it's some of the hardest work that Washingtonians have to do, to stay home for 14 days. So I mention this. You know, the more that we follow this health advice to isolate, the fastest we'll get back to baseball and football games where we can watch in person. Maybe that's an incentive. I hope so.
Next question comes from Jim with the News Tribune.
Hey, Governor, I was wondering if you could provide an update on testing. If you see any evidence of a national strategy on this, and also, does Washington have excess capacity, more capacity for testing than it needs, or do you think that at some point we'll reach the 22,000 a day?
Well, we do not have excess capacity today. We have one half of the equation in pretty good shape, and that's the machines that analyze the test samples. And we've got capacity on a good day to might be able to analyze as much as 20,000 samples. So we're in pretty good condition on that. However, the other half, which is the front half, which is the ability to collect the samples, and as you know, that has to be done through a FDA-approved process of the kind of swabs one uses and who takes the sample and how they're treated and conveyed to the laboratory. On that, we have not had satisfactory help from the federal government, and still have not, despite months of urging the federal government to be more productive in this regard. And I have to tell you, it's extremely frustrating. Just one small example, I don't know if I mentioned this to you the other day or not, but we were told a couple weeks ago the federal government would ship us about 500,000 swabs in May. Well, we'd received, I think, 10% as of the 13th or 14th, and then we got this big bulk package, and it said cotton swabs. Well, you can't use cotton swabs. It's not allowed. Then we find out they just put them in the wrong packages. And then we found out they didn't individually package them, so they're not sterile. So there's some very convoluted system we're going to have to go through to hopefully be able to use the next 100,000 plus that they've sent us. This is more than maddening. And so we've been told that there will be an accelerated contingent that will come to us in the next week or two. That's great. But we need to significantly stabilize that supply chain of the swabs and the transport medium. so we can get this job done. Now, it's been a good thing. We were told the FDA has approved a new type of swab that can be self-administered. That'll help families, we hope, as long as we have the supply moving forward. So we continue to hope that that sampling kit will become more available so we can actually do the testing that is necessary. And we need more testing in our state. There's no question about that. We have a plan to do that. I heard somebody say we don't have a plan. We have a plan. We just don't have the swabs. And that's why I've been so urgently requesting the president to make this a high national priority. And he continues to say he doesn't like being a supply clerk. So that's been disappointing.
Next question comes from Hannah with Cairo Radio.
Hi, Governor. I'm wondering if you can share with us when...
May I stop you just for a moment? Can I stop you just for a moment? Because I have to get this off my chest. When I heard Donald Trump say that testing was overrated, I about went through the roof. Our ability to open up the economy of the state of Washington depends on our ability to get testing. It depends on the ability of the federal government to fulfill its responsibility to the American people to get these swabs in million numbers. And to see the President of the United States diminish the importance of this, which is critical not only to the health of people, but the ability to open up our economy, it is more than disappointing. We need the full force and effect of the federal government here. And we deserve it. So I hope it comes. Thank you.
Okay, Governor, I wanted to ask a couple of questions. One, can you share with us when you expect to know when you'll be making the decision on whether or not we'll advance to phase two as a state by June 1st? And then also, what specific criteria are you going to have to see? Is it how many fewer deaths? How many testing supplies we have? Can you go over that for us?
Yeah, we'll presumably make the decision in the days leading up to June 1st. We want to have the right data. If we had enough data 4 days before to allow that to go to June 1st, we would certainly announce it. If we knew we weren't going to, we would announce that as well. We know people are frustrated by this. We know people are so anxious. The people who've lost their jobs because of this, the people whose small businesses are in question, the people who are trying to telecommute and has a beautiful two-year-old pulling on your leg when you're trying to do business. Look, the desire for this is huge. And we'll make a decision when we have that data. Now, the data, and forgive me if I've talked with you about this before, but it continues to be about a dozen pieces of information that we collect and monitor on an ongoing basis on a daily basis. We look at the percentage of tests that are positive. If that goes down, that's a good sign. We look at the number of tests that we can do a day to give this a better idea, and this is why testing is so important, to be able to determine what the virus is really doing in our community. We look at the date of onset of hospitalizations of people with COVID-19 symptoms and the date of onset of people who are hospitalized who actually have COVID-19. We look at the current status of the number of people in our hospitals that have COVID-19. We look at our fatalities, the number of fatalities on that date. And for all of these things, we look at the trends, obviously, to see which way they're trending. We look at the mobility data to determine how much people are moving around, because movement is sort of a proxy for physical interaction. The more movement, the more likelihood that you have transmission of the disease. We had achieved, we thought, maybe 50% reduction of mobility. That's down to maybe 30% at this point, as people are now reopening the economy and more people are moving around. We look at the surge capacity in our hospitals, as I talked about a few minutes ago, what type of additional capacity we have in our hospitals to move forward. Obviously, that entails ventilator capacity and capacity for hospital beds and ICU beds. We look at our PPE capacity. What kind of PPE do we have to be able to handle a surge, if it comes? So I may have left out a couple of the metrics, but those are all important in this assessment. And it would be so easy if any one of those numbers that could be dispositive, but that would be irresponsible to pick any one of those numbers because any one of those numbers could be dangerously incongruent with what's really happening. So we will look at those as we have in the past and make judgments based on medical advice, scientific data, and the best epidemiologists that we can talk to. Unfortunately, we have some good modelers to help us on this. I did leave out one very important number, and that is the R-naught number. It's an R with the symbol zero in the right-hand corner. That basically reflects how many people one person infects. So if the R-naught number is one, that means one person infects one other person. When we started this, that R-naught number was three. One person was infecting three people. We have now, again, because of the tremendous work of Washingtonians, we've driven that down to maybe around one, but it was creeping back up a week or two ago. And obviously, if it gets above one, the number of people who are infected begins to grow. So we want to look at that very, very carefully, and we have multiple modelers to help us model that. Fortunately, in Washington, we've got not only the smartest people who know why social distancing works, but some of the best geneticists and epidemiologists and modelers in the world are right here in the state of Washington.
Next question comes from Jerry with the Everett Herald.
Jerry?
There I am. Okay. Governor, first, two things. First, why is the state changing its process for billing counties for PPE that's, I believe, headed for the healthcare workers and first responders? They're looking at changing it in the next 2 weeks. And then second, I just wanted to follow up on the issue raised earlier about the toll of loss of life from COVID-19, and I don't think anyone would dispute that 887 deaths is horrific. But given the importance of metrics in your decision making, if one number is inaccurate, and it's a very prominent number in our reporting, are you not concerned it undermines the data and the confidence the public will have in your reliance on the data? I mean, would you review that process and consider changing how deaths are determined in this state?
Well, I haven't seen this assertion. I have no reason to believe there's any validity to it whatsoever. So at the moment, I have confidence in the numbers that we've put forward. They come from a variety of sources. I see no reason at the moment to believe that the fatality numbers are not consistent with reality. Now, there are cases, obviously, where if someone makes the wrong report, that could happen. But there's no reason to believe it's not on the lower number as opposed to a higher number. So I just want to make sure the record is clear. I have no reason to doubt the fatality numbers that we're using in the state of Washington right now. The problem is you got some people out there who are fanning these conspiracy claims from the planet Pluto. And it's just disgusting what they're trying to say of all these crazy deep state malarkey who are kind of suggest that this is not a problem in our state. I find that hard to accept with the number of dead in our state. So that's a problem, and I hope it gets resolved. Your first question as far as about billing counties, there is a question about this. We're working through it, talking to the counties. I don't think any final decisions have been made. As far as consideration, there has been, since this whole thing started, significant federal money that has got and will be going to cities. And so the question is, and this is a convoluted algebraic equation how this is done, but the long and short of it, we're talking to the cities, and we're going to see if we can work something out. It hasn't been resolved yet.
Final question goes to Kate with KUOW. Kate, are you there? Okay.
Kate, KOW?
All right, I guess you can watch it.
Kate, we'll try to get back to you if we missed you. Thank you very much. Again, I just want to say how much We appreciate the medical people, and I'm glad we're in a position to allow them to start to work their magic again. And I know all of us are grateful, but I don't think we can express it enough to the people who've walked into harm's way. And I know they've been really eager to get back to do all their work. And I do hope that people now will go back and see them at times where it's appropriate. Your health counts for all of your issues, not just COVID. And we hope you'll be willing to do that. And with that, please wash your hands. Thank you.